Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. If you like solving puzzles, my guest today has long offered the medical diagnostic version of problem solving, teaching readers how to think like a doctor and marshal both patient stories and evidence into a coherent diagnosis. Dr. Lisa Sanders writes a regular column in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in which she reports on real cases from patients who usually don't get better at first pass and subsequently require deeper analysis to find solutions. Her written work has led to interesting opportunities in television. For years, she was the medical consultant to the TV show House MD, which aired for 8 seasons. She's now the star of a new Netflix documentary series called Diagnosis, which uses crowdsourcing to help patients and families with very obscure diagnoses find kinship among more esoteric solutions. Her new book, like her column, is also called Diagnosis. Here the subtitle is Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries, and it's just out from Broadway Books. Her previous book was a bestseller called Every Patient Tells a Story. Lisa Sanders is an internal medicine physician and a faculty member at the Yale University School of Medicine, where she spoke to me from her office. Dr. Lisa Sanders, welcome to Medical Monday. It's such a joy to talk to you. I'm an avid reader of your columns in the New York Times Sunday Magazine and now the new book, Diagnosis, Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries. And if there's a theme here, you know, we have this adage in medicine, when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. And so there's a number of cases kind of divided up by symptoms in the book. And there are some zebras, there's some rare diagnoses here, but often what I find or what you've reported on are cases where there may be atypical or less frequently seen complications of very common things. For example, you had a case of what seemed like a garden variety strep throat, which was sort of overlooked, which turned into this complication that's called Lemierre's disease. I mean, share with us how you or how other doctors kind of approach diagnosis making.
John, thank you so much for inviting me on your Medical Monday. I think you just have to follow, you have to follow it with an open mind. I mean, if this young man had responded to, you know, if he had gotten better, we wouldn't have thought about him again. You know, we'd be like, okay, been there, done that, got the T-shirt. But it's when people don't get better that you have to stay engaged. That is one of the ways you know that you're just wrong. We have this discrepancy between how many symptoms our bodies are capable of exhibiting and how many diseases can cause those symptoms. You know, to me, it's like the analogy is the alphabet, 26 letters, and the words, millions of words that can be created out of this combination of letters. So lots of possibilities, lots of different diseases can come from very similar symptoms. And you just have to be open to the possibilities, and you have to be paying attention.
You make that point that people get better, we kind of forget about it because everyone's sort of happy. The doctor's happy. The patient's certainly happy. The family members are happy. But it's when we do something we think makes sense. We may not have a foolproof or clear diagnosis and a straightforward treatment. But a lot of times we do more broad treatment to try to play the odds. And so an example might be we think something's an infection, so we give antibiotics. And if someone gets better, great. If not, as often happens in your columns, we have to really think in a new way. And so that happens a lot. And I guess one of the examples that really stuck with me from the book was a patient who seemed to fall into that category of infection or an inflammatory condition. And none of the tests for infections or inflammation really panned out. But it turned out that some careful thinking really about the medications she was on, and she was on a number of common things. And in this case, it was a drug I think called allopurinol, which was maybe for gout. And who knew that, like, I prescribe this drug a lot and never think about the possibility of an allergic reaction, which I guess turned out to be the case.
Yes, she had DRESS. So what is that? Drug-related eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. I think that's what DRESS stands for. And, you know, it's got a classic presentation. I mean, people develop this whole body, I would call it a rash, but really she just was bright red from head to toe, plus a fever, plus these body aches, plus she had this very high level of eosinophils. The first time I heard about this disease, which was not when this patient had it, but sometime before, a patient had been on the team of one of my colleagues, Steve Holt, and he wasn't sure what was going on. So he he got together what somebody else, he didn't call it this, but somebody else has called a flash diagnostic mob. He called, you know, he asked all of his colleagues and all of the residents on his team and the team on his firm to come together, and he presented the case. And one of the residents said, you know, I read about something that's an allergic reaction called DRESS. Do you think it could be that? And it was totally that. And, you know, as doctors, we are drawn to stories. And so hearing that story made such an impression on me. I was on the team taking care of this patient who developed DRESS because of allopurinol, but I didn't make the diagnosis. It was somebody else on the team who made the diagnosis. But, you know, hearing about it twice, I feel like the next time I see it, I will totally diagnose it. And I have seen it, and I did diagnose it. But because once you see it, and once you hear the story, then it all makes sense to you, because that's how doctors think.
Well, one of the other themes, I think, in the book and in your writing and your columns is that it's the history. That is, as you point out, the story that a patient or a family member tells us as the doctors, that really about 80% of the time is what leads to a diagnosis. And it's much less so the things that we think of as the latest and greatest, the technology, the scans, all the blood tests. Those are important, sure, but oftentimes we can make the diagnosis from history alone. And that's a really good reminder, too, when you have that kind of group thinking where maybe a resident or a fellow or a student just says, hey, I read about this thing, and it's sort of this best guess. The wider a net you cast, the more likely you are, I guess, to find the right possibilities.
Right. If you don't have the right diagnosis on your list of things it might be, then the chances that you're going to make that diagnosis drop dramatically. And this has actually been shown when they study how doctors think and how doctors make diagnoses. They've shown this, that if it's not on your original list, then the chance that you are going to be the person who makes that diagnosis drop dramatically. So I encourage residents, and I try to force myself to approach things broadly and to try to nail down all the things that you think it could be, and then you decide which ones you think are the most likely. Obviously, you know, given that so many diseases share the same symptoms, you know, you're not going to put down everything it might be, but you should figure out all the things that it's likely to be.
And you're much more likely, of course, in that scenario to, yeah, go down the right pathway. Well, one of the cases in the book reminded me of something else, which was incredibly important. And a lot of times in internal medicine, the field we're both in, you have older patients because the older we get, the more likely we are to unfortunately suffer illnesses or conditions. And oftentimes older folks might have memory impairment or dementia, and so they may not be the best history providers, or the illness, the acute illness that they're suffering from may render them less capable of giving a history. And so in the particular case I'm thinking of, you saw, I mean, I can give away the diagnosis, which was typhus, epidemic typhus, which is something we read about in, you know, the concentration camp histories where there's pestilence and people in starvation. But what was interesting in this case was the woman had squirrels in her attic, and that seemed to be the vector from which she caught typhus. But the crack in the case really came from her adult children, her family members, without whom we never would have gotten that history at all.
Exactly right. I mean, it was her son who made a joke and then heard himself and went, huh. And it wasn't just squirrels. Let me just be clear. It's flying squirrels.
Oh, okay. So thank you.
That's a different version. But they're a known vector for epidemic typhus. That's how people get it. But fortunately, it's still extremely unusual. I mean, very few cases every year, which is good because this woman just about died. If she hadn't been so incredibly healthy, I don't know what would have happened to her. But, you know, up until she got this febrile illness, you know, she was chopping her own wood, you know. I mean, she was an incredibly active, vibrant woman. So she was in the best shape possible to get an absolutely devastating infection.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Lisa Sanders, who is on faculty at the Yale University School of Medicine. She also writes the diagnosis column for the New York Times Magazine, the best of which have just been compiled into a new book called Diagnosis, Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries, and also is the star of a Netflix documentary series called Diagnosis, which is really interesting, 7-episode series And Lisa, how do you find your cases? You must get asked that all the time. I mean, some of them seem like they are your own cases or cases at Yale, but in your columns and on Netflix, these are cases from all over the country, New Mexico, South Dakota. So how do they make their way to you?
That was quite a process. They actually had people looking, they hired people to look for cases for me. And so when they would find an interesting case, you know, they would talk to the patient and see if the patient was interested in doing it. And if it was something, you know, if their family was willing to have this kind of invasion, and then they would send them to me. And I tried to pick cases that I thought could be solved. Sometimes people feel very frustrated because they feel like they've had lots of testing and all their testing is normal. The testing doesn't get them anywhere. And I always worry about that because if there's nothing objective, it's hard to know where to go with that. So I tried to pick cases where I felt like there was something that we could focus on. And we got a pretty interesting variety of cases, I think.
Well, you definitely do. And what struck me as really interesting about the show was two things. And I've watched several of the episodes. One was that you really used crowdsourcing, the idea that the hive mind, that people from across the world really will respond into these challenging cases and come up with their own ideas. And I mean, I guess in the routine column, people always send in comments or answers when you frame them as questions, although sometimes you present it just as a set and done case. So it's really interesting to find that the crowdsourcing. And what I'm curious about is sometimes you get experts who write in, who they don't just write in, they send video answers of themselves to the New York Times. And these can be world experts, scientists, physicians, but then they can also be people who are also afflicted with conditions or family members of people who are so afflicted. And so you have this wide range of, I would say, experts to amateurs. And yet, is there any way to categorize the percentage of each? I mean, who's answering these, please?
Well, first of all, I have to say, John, that the reason I ever thought of crowdsourcing, you know, crowdsourcing, I first did it in my column called Think Like a Doctor, which I wrote for about 6 years, and I would present a solved case, but I would present it as if it were unsolved and ask people to contribute their answers and try to figure out what was going on. But I totally got that from you.
From me?
Yes, you were involved in the care of a friend of yours who was a professor in Boston, I don't want to say his name, who was worried about a febrile illness that he had. And you suggested that he put his case before a bunch of doctors through Kevin MD. Do you remember this case?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was. I give him the credit. It was all his idea because he's a very computer savvy, trust the crowd kind of person.
Right. And so I was like, that, and he got answers, right answers, almost immediately. It was amazing to me. And I just thought, wow, that is such an interesting idea. That is such a great idea. So, you know, it percolated in my brain. I don't remember what year it was that I read about this, but I was fascinated by it, and that's what eventually turned into my own Think Like a Doctor column, and which eventually turned into the show, Diagnosis. And, you know, I think it was such an interesting idea. We did hear from all kinds of people in putting this together. We heard from experts. We heard from regular people. We heard from people who just were interested enough to do some searching on Google or whatever their search engine is, just to see if they could figure it out.
Almost,
you know, because
like
it is kind of a mystery story.
Solving a puzzle, exactly, yeah. You know, one thing that struck me too, it seemed like in several of the episodes, at least who got featured, were people from Denmark. Is there something about the Danish that are particularly good at solving medical mysteries, or is that just a coincidence?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it was in the episode with Kamaya, she ended up going to Denmark because that was where a child who had the same exact kind of problem that she had was found. And, you know, that was amazing. That was totally amazing. So I don't think, I don't know what it is about Denmark, but I'm glad they have it, whatever it is.
Yeah. And one thing I think that's also really fascinating about the program, the Netflix series, is you go to crowdsourcing, which often does lead to a much more clear diagnosis than a lot of these patients who have these relatively rare things are able to find from their own doctors or even going far away to specialty hospitals. But a lot of times, it's sort of the best guess. And I'll give you an example. So there's one of the stories is about a soldier, an ex-soldier, who winds up developing some memory problems and cognitive issues. And it comes down to a differential where some of the experts think he has this condition called neuro-Behçet's. Behçet's disease is an autoimmune phenomenon. It's pretty rare. And they thought, based on some of the characteristic patterns of his MRI and his behavior, that it might be this. Other experts seem to think he had a condition called PML. And then you also talked with people from the Veterans Administration who thought he had what came out as Gulf War Syndrome, which, as you pointed out in the program, you know, it was right there in his history that he'd served in the Gulf War. And yet there's a lot of, I think, controversy as to, you know, how real, I guess, this phenomenon is. And yet that what really happened was he was able to at least have some identification around that and then get, I guess, what we call service connected in relation to his service and get more services from the Veterans Administration for his PTSD and other things. So there was a sort of happy ending, although, you know, you're left wondering, this poor guy, I mean, it sounds like he might actually just get worse.
Yes. Well, you know, what was amazing about that is that he went to really smart, thoughtful, caring doctors. He really got extraordinary help before he ever came to us. He got 2 brain biopsies at the Mayo Clinic, you know, amazing, and that were unrevealing. But in all of his hundreds of pages of medical records, which I went through, not a single person connected his illness with his service. And it really took the crowd to do that. I would say that was the clearest success for the crowd, is that lots and lots and lots of people saw this right away, something that his doctors had just not seen. I hadn't seen it for sure. I'm not one of his doctors. I was just a reporter. But I hadn't thought of it for sure, and neither had any of his doctors. And so the crowd really was able to see things in a different perspective, and that's really an extraordinary gift, I would say. You know, that is really the virtue of the crowd, is that they approach something, or the possibility of approaching something from a completely different perspective is there all the time.
I can't help but wonder, too, it seemed like for a lot of the people who would dial in for trying to solve the medical mysteries, it seemed like they're searching for almost camaraderie or collectivism, like that other people are suffering with this, which may be common or may be rare, but they're almost looking for, as one of the moms said, it takes a village. And so she was looking for that village for her child that had this very rare condition.
Well, that was the other great gift from the crowd, I thought, is how much these people who feel alone. I mean, when you think about going to a doctor, you do not think that at the end of the day, the doctor is going to go, I don't know what it is. I wish you luck, you know, and feel, or we have to keep looking. Whatever it is, you just feel like that is not the way it's supposed to work. The way it's supposed to work is you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, you have X, Y, or Z. And so I think there's a lot of feeling isolated and alone by these patients who don't have a diagnosis, can't tell their friends or family or bosses or teachers, I have X, and so this is what it does to me. You have to say, I have something, and I'm sick. That doesn't feel good, and it feels alone. And one of the great, I think, gifts from the crowd is this outpouring of good wishes and sincere thoughts and camaraderie. You know, people say, oh, I had something just like that. So, you know, be tough, you know, you got to keep going. You know, lots of enthusiasm and encouragement for these people who felt up until then so alone and so isolated.
You are listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Lisa Sanders, who is on the faculty at Yale School of Medicine, also is the diagnosis columnist for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and author of the new book based on her columns called Diagnosis, Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries, and the star of a Netflix documentary series based on her columns, which is also called Diagnosis. And Lisa, one more question about the show. There was one episode that was really interesting where we've talked a little bit about this young girl who had this mysterious illness and wound up getting into the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, where in Bethesda, Maryland, where they actually have a functioning hospital. They mostly, you know, do research, but they have this clinical arm that looks at rare diseases. And so this young girl was able to get enrolled. And a couple of questions. One is, I don't know if you were there or just the crew went and actually filmed there. That must have been pretty interesting. But then secondly, it seemed like in the episode, and you asked them a sensitive question, it seemed like they sort of dropped the ball because there was a transition in this program, and it took them more than 2 years to get back to the poor mom of this child who had this terrible affliction. And I guess I was just wondering for any inside baseball on that scoop, on that NIH visit.
Well, I think that our calling, the NIH, helped them find the records, you know, and help them recognize that they hadn't closed the loop on that. You know, they see a lot of patients, and they do such a thorough workup. You know, I mean, I have nothing but admiration for the NIH. And, you know, as soon as they saw that they hadn't closed the loop on this, they called the mom and said, oh, we have an answer for you. She was very grateful. But then that just led to another set of problems, like, oh, what does this answer mean? I mean, the answer was that her daughter had this extremely rare genetic abnormality. And according to the NIH, there were just this handful of other people who had it. And she was like, oh, now what? And they didn't even know how to tell the mom how to reach any of those other people because they just had seen them in the literature. So I thought it was a great way for her to connect with these other people through the Netflix show. And she really was showered with people who reached out to her and said, oh, my child has the same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, it's that kindredness that I think makes the show really special and poignant in addition to the kind of the puzzle aspect of it. Now, Lisa, this was not your first at all experience in television. In fact, you were a consultant, I believe, on the very popular show House MD. And how did that come about? And what kind of work did you do on that program?
Well, that came about the same way in some ways as the Netflix show. Somebody who was a fan of my column thought, oh, this would be interesting television. He came from fiction television, and so he thought of it in terms of telling a made-up story. And he reached out to me and asked me if I would be interested in working on this show. I said, oh, he didn't tell me it was based on my column, but I heard that later.
So did you?
But initially he just said, you know, I have this show that I'm working on, and I wonder whether you'd be interested in it.
And did this involve you going to wherever the writer's room was in Hollywood or wherever to be involved in, or were you just called in kind of after the fact to kind of script doctor and make sure things were medically accurate?
Both. You know, I tried to go out there once a year. I didn't always because California, it turns out, is a long way away. but, you know, I tried to go out there not because they needed me out there in any way. We mostly communicated through email and by phone, but it was cool. You know, I mean, and I wanted to know the people that I was talking to and writing to. And besides, it was exciting to see these actors, to see this set, to go there. I mean, I went there because I thought it would be fun, and it was. I helped them come up with the medical story. So the writers were there to tell the human story, which they considered the real story. And me and two other doctors who came on at different times in the show were there to help them think up medical stories, which they really thought of as the backdrop, which I thought was the foreground. But, you know, that's just a matter of perspective.
Well, your career, you started as a journalist and a writer and a newsie, and it was a very formative experience as a news person that led you sort of at a slightly later age to go back and go to medical school. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was a television producer, I produced for CBS's morning show, and one day I was out with one of the doctors that I worked with, Dr. Bob Arnott, and we were doing something on whitewater rafting. And we were actually rehearsing for a live shot that we were going to do, and Bob just disappeared. He disappeared into the water. And when we saw him again, he was on a raft coming down through rapids, and he just disappeared. When we saw him again, he was on the side of the river, on the stony banks of this river, and he was pulling this elderly woman out of the water. And her eyes were closed, she looked quite pale, and he started doing CPR on her. Something I had really never seen except on television. And amazingly, she came back. You know, she turned her head. A ton of water gushed out of her mouth. She opened her eyes and sat up. So he saved her life. And looking at that, it's not like I thought, okay, I'm leaving TV, I'm going to go to medical school because I want to save people's lives. But it did occur to me that being in television meant that I was probably never going to save anybody's life, that I was in sort of the wrong business. But it had never really occurred to me that I wanted to save anybody's life. It had never crossed my mind as a possibility. And that, seeing that, made me understand that that was a possibility if I was interested. And it turns out I was interested, and I'm still interested.
And I've read several things about you, including, I should say, there was a really great Times Insider column about your work and about the show. And it was interesting to know that when you saw like the first cut of the Netflix series, you said, oh, this is terrible. So you can't do that. I'm quoting you from the article. So they had to kind of go back and reshoot some of this. Is that right?
They didn't have to reshoot anything. They had to just rethink what they wanted to do. Like, I had very strong feelings about how these stories should be told and our obligation to the viewer. Like, even if patients don't understand their illness correctly, it's our obligation to make sure that the information we give to the viewer is correct. We can't let misinformation exist out there. So to the extent possible, I thought that that was an important component of this. Well, that was the biggest thing. I also thought that people couldn't just be shown suffering, that, you know, other parts of their lives needed to be part of it. So, you know, I had very strong feelings that I wasn't even aware that I had. And then I looked at this and I realized, oh, that's not quite the TV show I want to make. And fortunately, they agreed with me and recut it. And I was really happy with the way it turned out.
Well, the show is really compelling. I have just one last question, which is, did you know when you made this big career transition to go into medicine, did you know at the time that you would still have sort of the writer's bug and continue to write, or was that more something you just put aside and then it sort of came back to you when you finally were out practicing?
I didn't think. I thought, okay, that's enough of that. Now on to something completely different. Not recognizing that, of course, it's not completely different, that the doctor's brain is really a storyteller's brain, and that we communicate and understand bodies and illness and sickness and diagnosis through stories. I had no idea. But then I did. When I did, I was like, okay, I got this.
Well, and you've done it incredibly well for quite a long time now in the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, where she writes the diagnosis column. Has the new book out, which is the best of her Times Magazine columns. It's called Diagnosis, Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries. And then a really compelling Netflix documentary series also called Diagnosis. And those are all by my guest today, Dr. Lisa Sanders. Lisa, it's been such an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.